terribly sorry for all the delay. We're running rather late. Our next two speakers, their topic is Rediscovering Toscanini, the Man Behind the Legend. The two speakers are Susanna Cleveland, who is the Music Recordings and Digital Resources Librarian at the University of North Texas, where her duties include managing the Audio Center and overseeing digitization projects for the music library. And her colleague is Dr. Mark McKnight, is Associate Head of the Music Library at the University of North Texas and teaches courses in music research and American music for the UNT College of Music. So you're the first speaker, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry we don't have any videos. The story of art. Oh, yeah.
You are listening to Toscanini, the man behind the legend. This is Ben Grauer, your host and commentator on Toscanini, the man behind the legend. Welcome once again to NBC Radio's award-winning commemorative series honoring the memory of the man who for 17 years conducted the NBC Symphony Orchestra and who for almost 70 years, with podium and baton, dominated the world of symphony and opera.
The story of Arturo Toscanini's rise to fame as one of history's most celebrated conductors is well known. Having spent the first several years of his professional life in the opera pit, Toscanini also gained a reputation for his symphonic conducting, serving as principal conductor of the New York Philharmonic from 1929 to 1936. When he left that post and retired to his native Italy, his American fans believed they would never again see the maestro conduct here. At the age of 70, however, when most individuals are happily settled into retirement, Toscanini returned to the podium, this time in a completely new forum as head of the recently organized NBC Symphony Orchestra. He would remain with the orchestra until his final departure in 1954. Toscanini died 3 years later in New York, just 2 months before his 90th birthday. Toscanini's association with the NBC Symphony has been documented by a number of writers, most notably by Joseph Horowitz in his somewhat harsh revisionist study, Understanding Toscanini, and more sympathetically in Mortimer Frank's 2002 book, Arturo Toscanini, The NBC Years. As Donald C. Meyer has noted, this new venture was a, quote, uniquely American phenomenon, a commercial network dabbling in fine orchestral music, struggling with its conflicting urges between public service and profit, high culture and entertainment. It was Toscanini's reputation in the opera and concert halls that had compelled David Sarnoff, the president of RCA, NBC's parent company, so assiduously to seek out the maestro to head his corporation's new enterprise in 1937. But it was primarily Toscanini's tenure with NBC and his recordings that secured the conductor's legacy. Because of this association, today we can appreciate and understand Toscanini's artistry and his mystique much more fully, since most of Toscanini's commercial recordings were made after he came to NBC. These recordings are available today on compact disc through the comprehensive 82-disc set RCA reissued between 1990 and 1992. 74 discs of this set include all of Toscanini's approved performances with the NBC Symphony. Mortimer Frank's book discusses this recorded legacy in painstaking detail and includes a season-by-season chronology of broadcast performances of the NBC Symphony, as well as several discographical and other useful appendices. Although commercial recordings remain among the most important and widely used types of sources in the study of conductors and their performances, they reveal only part of the story. As thorough as Frank's discography and survey of Toscanini's performances are, other documents not listed in his book also bear consideration in any full examination of Toscanini's life and career. Among these sources are materials in the Don Gillis collection, acquired by the University of North Texas Music Library as a gift from the composer's widow, Barbara Gillis, following her husband's death in 1978. And I would just like to take a moment to recognize Mrs. Gillis, who is here today with us. She recently moved to Austin. Gillis, a longtime associate of Toscanini, was himself a prominent and prolific composer and arranger who had served as the conductor's assistant and the producer for the NBC Symphony broadcast concerts from 1944 until they ended 10 years later. Following Toscanini's death and the disbanding of the orchestra, it was Gillis who reorganized the NBC Symphony under the new name Symphony of the Air. The Gillis Archive meticulously documents Gillis's own multifaceted life in music as a performer, composer, arranger, radio producer, and educator. The Toscanini-related materials in the collection include all the usual types of archival documents: letters, clippings, press releases, reviews, radio program scripts, etc. Perhaps equally, if not more important, are the hundreds of tape recordings that Gillis possessed. These tapes fall into several categories: recordings of Gillis's own music, which complement the manuscripts and other related material in the archive; rehearsals of the NBC Symphony; complete tapes of the NBC radio programs Toscanini, The Man Behind the Legend, and the Toscanini Centennial Series; and the interviews conducted for these two programs. According to Gillis, the radio series Toscanini, The Man Behind the Legend, was the brainchild of NBC Radio's Vice President for Programming, Robert Wogan. In early 1963, Wogan approached Gillis and Toscanini's son, Walter, with the idea to present a 13-week series of radio programs that recalled the, quote, golden years of the Toscanini life and legend. Walter Toscanini agreed to let Gillis use the Toscanini archives, then housed in the family's home, Villa Pauline in Riverdale, New York. In addition, the American Federation of Musicians granted the rights to the NBC Symphony rehearsals that had been recorded. What initially began as one 13-week series continued for 4 years, culminating in the year-long Centennial Series, which ran throughout 1967, marking the 100th anniversary of the conductor's birth. In discussing the series in a January 1966 article in Allegro magazine, Gillis wrote that the programs were intended, quote, to explore the legends, to examine the myths, and to probe deeply into the many facets of Maestro's artistic life, which caused him to become so uniquely the Maestro. The weekly programs included not only performances by the NBC Symphony, but also rehearsals, biographical commentary, and interviews of hundreds of individuals, persons great and small, from esteemed conductors, critics, composers, and performers, to former players in the orchestra and members of Toscanini's household staff, his cook, valet, and driver. As Gillis noted, the programs, in addition to their focus on Toscanini's music making, helped to, quote, tell the story of Maestro at home, the man of family in his hours away from the podium. Following is a brief sampling of the many different persons who appeared on the broadcasts and their various impressions and remembrances of the Maestro. And the first three we'll hear in succession are Eugene Ormandy, Lotte Lehmann, and the conductor Wilfred Pelletier.
From Eugene Ormandy, conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra and longtime friend and colleague of Maestro.
I heard so much about this great Italian conductor, but I could not believe that anybody is greater than the ones I've heard before him. But when I heard Toscanini, I realized that none could even compare to him. He was one conductor who came to the rehearsals not only well prepared, but he knew everything he wanted. He was an uncanny human being. He's well be a legend, not only now, but, he was a legend in his lifetime, but he will be a legend as far as we conductors are concerned for many, many, many decades.
Lotte Lehmann.
Maestro Toscanini's friendship and his appreciation for me as an artist have been the climax of my career. And so I feel in remembering my association with Toscanini. The overwhelming strength of his magical personality is akin to the power of the ocean, devastating in its fury, inspiring in its grandeur.
one word Maestro had, as he had in music, he had also in the world of ideas, penetration, insight. He went right to the heart.
To the soul of the music, you know. One day he was unable at one rehearsal, I don't know if you saw that, he was trying to get a mood from the orchestra. He couldn't get it. He was trying in English, in Italian. He got mad. He couldn't get it. Finally, he took his handkerchief and opened it up and let it fall down. See, that's what I want, gentlemen. I don't want any resistance from any musician. I want it fall down that way.
These interviews also help refute the charge that Toscanini ignored contemporary music. Here is Aaron Copland discussing Toscanini's performance of El Salón México.
We'll begin with Aaron Copland, whose Salón México Maestro had performed. I asked Mr. Copland, how did it all come about?
Why, I don't remember the exact circumstance, but I definitely remember being at the performance and being amazed that he knew it all by heart. We met afterwards, you know, in the green room.
I asked composer Aaron Copland if he'd gone to any of Maestro's rehearsals of his Salón México.
No, I didn't attend rehearsals. But I do remember, in the green room, his seeming a little disturbed. And I wondered what was bothering him. And apparently the rhythmic complications of the piece had caused him considerable headache. I wasn't aware of his having any difficulties. I also liked the fact that when I came into the green room, he addressed me suddenly as Maestro. I mean, that was a shock, because we had always thought that he was the only Maestro in America. People call you Maestro in South America or in Europe. But here, Maestro used to be reserved for Toscanini, so it was sort of fun to be called Maestro by the Maestro himself.
The NBC Symphony also undertook a number of tours, even venturing as far as Austin, Texas. Here is publicist Leonard Myers discussing one particular concert which took place here in Austin on April 29th, 1950.
One occasion, we played three cities in Texas, Houston, Dallas, and Austin. As a matter of fact, since it was Texas, you can be pretty sure there were several stories attached to each city. I won't go through all of them, but one is particularly revealing about Toscanini and his attitude toward music. He had about six different programs prepared for the tour. And on this program that was going to be done in Austin, he was doing the Schubert B-flat, the Unfinished Symphony, and he was also doing the Dvořák New World Symphony. Well, about 2 weeks before we arrived there, we received a protest from the local managers, and this was based upon the, I believe it was the dean of the School of Music at the University of Texas, which is located in Austin. Complaining that this was a light program and that Maestro was playing down to the audience. Mm-hmm. Well, since Maestro had done the Eroica Symphony and a great many other, and La Mer and a great many other fine works on the series, they thought perhaps he would substitute these. Mm-hmm. Well, the subject was broached to Toscanini, and he stormily refused to change it. If they had come to him and said, Maestro, the sponsors of the concert in Austin would love to hear the Eroica Symphony. Would you consider putting that on the program? He would have put it on in a minute.
Uh-huh.
But he wouldn't change the program because they were making a deprecating remark about Schubert and about Dvořák.
Right.
And this was music he loved, and he insisted upon playing it. Well, after the concert, these people who had objected to the program came up and said, we had never really heard these works before. They were just revealed to us as they should be played, and it is great music.
In the following excerpt, Edith Kusterman, Toscanini's cook, recalls her years cooking for Maestro as well as for Koussevitzky.
You were cooking for Maestro in the winter.
Yes,
and for
and
another,
summer for Koussevitzky.
For Koussevitzky.
Yes.
Well, we'll avoid all musical comparisons, naturally, but I would be interested in...
It was very different. Very different.
Well, let's start with the soup. Soup was not the main dish.
No, you know, they didn't... the Toscanini house was a house with great, great culture of cooking, and Mrs. Shea knew such a lot. And in the Kusevitsky house, there was such a lot of guests and such a commotion and traffic. It was also very good, I would say, but a different style altogether.
Different style.
Finally, we hear another side of Toscanini, perhaps what he might have done with his life had he not picked up the baton as a young man.
Did Maestro ever ask you specific technical things about wrestling, how this hold is done, what's an important hold, what's a turning point in a belt?
Yes. He was amazed me. He was amazed about my balance of wrestling. And I said, Maestro.
Balance, you say?
It's a different balance. See, Ben, I am an improviser in wrestling. My style changes every day. I adapt myself with my opponent. And that's why Toscanini was admiring, because I was an improviser. I love to change my style every day.
Did he ever ask you to demonstrate or show him a hold?
Oh, yes.
Did you put hands on him?
Oh, yes.
Put a hold on him?
Yes, yes.
This
yes.
man 50 years older than you?
Yes, yes.
Did he resist?
Ben, he was a very strong man, I'm telling you. Toscanini, in my opinion, if Toscanini was training hard, he could be a very good wrestler at his frame, you know, and the weight.
In his class, he would have been a champ.
Positively. I bet anything that Toscanini could be a champ.
That was, by the way, the wrestler Antonino Rocca, who was interviewed for one of the segments. And I found this on a wrestling website, by the way. The popularity and longevity of the series at a time when such live commercial radio programs would soon become largely a thing of the past were a testament to Toscanini's enduring impact. Gillis wrote that these programs introduced a whole new generation to Toscanini. Quote, "The most amazing thing that happened was that we began hearing from so many teenagers wanting to know more about the maestro. Some letters were from youngsters who, of their own volition, had pooled their collections of Toscanini recordings and got together regularly to listen to them. Other young people wrote to express regret at not having seen Maestro in person. Some critics might view the program simply as an extension of the NBC perpetuated hagiography of the conductor with little critical balanced perspective of continuing the Toscanini myth. To be sure, nothing in the programs alludes to Toscanini's extramarital affairs or criticizes his musical interpretations or choice of repertoire. On the other hand, it is possible that a fuller and more balanced view of Toscanini emerges when scholars can examine the unpublished, unedited documents, such as those available in the Gillis archive. In many ways, it was Don Gillis himself who was the man behind the legend. The University of North Texas Music Library is pleased to be the custodian of this important collection and has taken steps to preserve the collection and, at the same time, make it more available to scholars. Susanna Cleveland will now discuss the particular details of these efforts.
In 1994, the University of North Texas began a project to restore and transfer to CD all of the almost 500 tapes in the Don Gillis collection. The project was made possible by the generosity of several private donors in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. The tapes were assessed by consultant Steve Smolian, who then made recommendations for how to proceed with the preservation and transfer of the tapes. The next several years were spent raising additional money to purchase equipment and furniture for a sound preservation studio. In 1998, Steve returned to UNT and oversaw its assembly in the music library. The private donations provided for the purchase of equipment for this project, related consulting fees, blank media, and wages for the student assistants who carried out the work. We were able to purchase equipment for the studio beyond what was necessary for this project alone, thereby setting up the lab so that we could use it for a number of different future projects. Most of the tapes are acetate quarter-inch tapes and are recorded at either 15 or 30 IPS mono. The condition of the tapes was not superb, but the two most common problems, broken splices and edge warping from previous scatter winding, were fairly simple to repair. We acquired two refurbished Atari MTR-10 tape recorders to play the tapes in both the restoration and transfer phases of the project. For each tape was cleaned, splices repaired, and timing and speed noted. After restoration work, the tapes were wound slowly to ensure even tape pack, housed on new reels and in new boxes when necessary, and set aside for 6 months. For the transfer phase, we copied the tapes directly to CD using a Marantz CD burner with no editing or cleaning of the sound. Direct-to-computer file transfer was not considered at the time because of the infeasibility of file storage and management at that stage. Student assistants indexed the discs according to content at the time of transfer. In the years since, we've had various students working on projects to identify more precisely the individuals interviewed. After transfer, the tapes were all wound slowly and stored tail out. The original tapes and CD transfers are now kept in climate and humidity-controlled storage in the music library. Access to the recordings is provided for researchers within the library with special permission. Recently, we have created a website for the Don Gillis Collection, which includes finding aids for both Gillis's works and papers and the Toscanini Collection. And we had some brochures that have our URL on them. That's where you can go to start to find that site. Through his production of the radio shows and efforts to deposit these source materials in a library collection, Don Gillis went to great lengths to help the public to discover not only Toscanini the conductor, but Toscanini the man as well. By preserving and providing access to this important collection, we're hoping to give researchers the opportunity to rediscover the man behind the Toscanini myth.
You're most cordially invited to be with us next week and each succeeding week as NBC Radio continues to bring you Toscanini, the man behind the legend. Our writer-producer for this broadcast series is Don Gillis. Our NBC director is Bern Meyer. Your host and commentator is Ben Grauer.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
If any of you do have some question and answers, but you want to have a coffee break, they'll talk with you out there, or they'll answer a few here, if you prefer. Yes, sir.
I used to listen to this show when I was in high school, and when I was doing research at NBC, I was horrified when I found a file cabinet drawer with a listing of the disc series that NBC was throwing out. They tossed out the 16-inch dubbings of that series, unless somebody was able to snatch it before they went out. Obviously, the master tapes are a lot better, and I'm very happy to hear about this collection. Because I was really worried what might have happened if those discs were the only library set of that program.
We do have a complete set that we've tried to rescue.
But
now,
you don't have any discs.
No discs at all. I don't. Mrs. Gillis, do you know what happened to the transcription discs?
I really don't know what happened to the transcription discs. I do remember hearing this about the
I saw the thing about this, the discs of this series that were going, that were being tossed out. That was around 1971 when I saw this.
That they were good.
I'll go back to my files and I'll try to find the, because I jotted down the information of what the date periods were of the discs that they were going to be, of all the different series that they were going to be tossing out. Yeah, so I think what it means is that NBC probably does not have a set of these programs in their Library of Congress files.
There's a set at New York Public Library.
Probably from Wave Hill, perhaps.
From from different places, actually.
Yeah.
Do you know whether there's any discussion of the NBC Symphony's commissioning Duke Ellington to write its Harlem music in 1950?
Did you come
and, which was, of course, never conducted by Toscanini, never performed by NBC. Duke Ellington itself. But there were reasons for that. But
it's probably in Frank's book if it did happen.
Frank's book?
The Mortimer Frank's book, Arturo Toscanini, The NBC Years. It's very thorough as far as what they did and what they didn't do.
It was originally commissioned by NBC and it was possibly Toscanini's participation.
But
they never
performed.
Did it and he never conducted it. So I'm just wondering if there's anything there. Don Gilson would have had to have been involved if NBC Symphony was involved in the actual creation of the work.
There could be something in the papers that discusses that, and we haven't done a thorough survey of the papers at this stage. We've mostly just been concerned with trying to preserve the tapes. And I never came across anything in all of the tapes about that at all. Yes?
What tapes exist in this collection of the Symphony of the Air era after the NBC Symphony itself?
Honestly, I don't recall having seen any of those at all. The most of the performance tapes that we have are rehearsal tapes, and they're all Toscanini in this set of the performances, other than the separate ones of Gillis's works.
That's it.
Thank
all
you
right.
very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you for your
Thank patience. You for your attention.
Excuse me. I've been informed by the program chair that the next session is going to start as close to 4 o'clock as possible, so your break is a little truncated. Sorry. Thank you.
We had a lot of technical problems.
And that kind of a day.
We actually had to change the
yes, that one
is yours too. Okay.
Thanks.
Wait, I think that's good. Does that go with this? Sorry, I just wanted to put it in case and I didn't realize. It is, but then every now and then it's
one of my DVDs, I have to get the other one out.
Oh, you're holding.
And that's what goes in there. So if you could be so kind as to provide me with an email address regarding any questions.
Let me give you a card.
Great. Well, take your time. I've got a few minutes to.
Okay.